You're listening to We Are STS. It's a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is Lucky Episode 13. Natural history documentaries are hugely popular on British television. They're great examples of science communication, and they have a long history stretching back to the early days of broadcasting by the BBC. As luck would have it, here in STS, we have an expert in these programs and the people who create them. Dr. Jean-Baptiste Guyon is Associate Professor in Science Communication in the department. He teaches science journalism, sociology of science, and lots more. A few years ago, Jean-Baptiste published a book on the history of British natural history documentaries. It's titled BBC Wildlife Documentaries in the Age of Attenborough. And yes, while researching it, he met and interviewed the one and only David Attenborough. To find out more about this work, to talk about what we can learn from the history of the subject, and definitely to find out what it's like to meet David Attenborough, I invited Jean-Baptiste in for a conversation. For our recording, we met outside in central London, along Regent's Canal, on a gorgeous summer day. But I have to warn you, there is plenty of noise in the background. Try to pick out the ducks and the coots, the runners and walkers, the gusts of wind, the passing canal boats, the motorcycles, the helicopters, and so much more. Gosh, there was a lot of background noise. Well, just think of it as adding a bit of atmosphere and we'll all be fine.
So hello, my name is Jean-Baptiste Guyon. I am an associate professor in science communication in the science studies department. My job essentially is to teach courses about science communication. I teach a course on science journalism, and I'm also undergraduate tutor, which means that I try to assist all students with difficulties during that time in the department.
So what is science communication?
That's a very good question. Science communication can be many things. Some people, and a vast majority of people, tend to see it as a special thing, as the dissemination of scientific knowledge to non-specialist audiences. I personally tend to adopt a more Catholic view of science communication, and I consider that it's any discourse about science which is held in public, knowing that the very notion of public is something which is quite difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. It's not a public doesn't exist in nature, in the wild, if you want. It's something which is created by a discourse, so publics are constantly changing, they are not fixed. And basically, any time somebody utters something about science to somebody else, it is a form of science communication.
When I have to explain science communication to my dad, I often say it's science journalism, but that's not true, is it?
There is a fierce debate in the community of science communication scholars as to whether science journalism and science communication are the same thing or not. Mm-hmm. There is a tendency to distinguish between the two because increasingly science communication tends to be seen as something which is done on purpose to educate people about science, whereas science journalism is something much broader, which is something which you could define as being about empowering people about science, because journalists' role is to work for the governed and not the governors. And science is something which governs us. So as people governed by science, we need journalists to empower us in relation to science. Sometimes science journalism can stand at odds with a kind of institutional or official understanding of science communication, because science journalism has to enable itself to be critical about science, to ask questions of science, which science communicators, which often see themselves as working to promote science, and will not do, and will refuse to do, actually.
So Jean-Baptiste, really what I wanted to do was I wanted to talk about your book, your 2019 book, BBC Wildlife Documentaries in the Age of Attenborough. And I love that phrase, Age of Attenborough. But first of all, could you just quickly summarize what the book is about?
Basically, it's about the history of wildlife television in Britain, mostly during the post-war period. But in the first chapter, there is an incursion before the Second World War. And it's really about understanding how the making of natural history television has evolved during that period. And I think one of the ideas which is very central to science communication scholarship is to say that the people who communicate science are in fact people who participate in the production of scientific knowledge, in the production of science. And that's what the book is really trying to show, basically, that wildlife filmmakers are not some people who stand downstream to scientists, but they've constantly worked in collaboration with scientists to produce their programs, but at the same time, they've indeed participated in making the science of animals, plants, etc. Evolve, develop.
This is what makes your book fantastic STS material, because you've written, in one sense, you've written a history of wildlife documentaries from about the 1930s to about the 1970s. So if I wanted to know about that, this is a nice book for that. But also you do that wonderful STS turn where you analyze what's going on. Let's talk about the analysis that you bring into your book. So you talk, for example, about the relationship between making films that show what's happening in the world and making films that tell a story.
Yes.
And sometimes those aren't the same thing. So can you talk a little bit about that kind of relationship?
To answer your question, I think that there was a belief earlier about filmmaking that it was something somehow neutral, just a passive recording device, and that by making films you could just show what was in the world. But not very quickly, but slowly, people realized that if you want to capture audiences' attention, if you want to keep audiences' attention, you have to tell a story, and you will inevitably tell a story. So a filmmaker not only has to be skilled at producing nice images which are pleasing to look at or which are accurately informative, but they also need to be able to tell a story through editing together of all these images, of all those sequences. And so I think the book is about the progressive realization of this storytelling imperative which dawns on wildlife filmmakers. The kind of climax of this evolution being David Attenborough's Life on Earth series, which has shaped the way in which wildlife television is produced ever since.
Can you say something about the role of the scientist in crafting these kinds of programs?
Yeah, so there are perhaps two moments in the relationship between scientists and wildlife filmmakers. I think the first one is the one which is taking place in the early 60s, which is basically the idea that at some point in the late 50s, early 60s, some scientists, especially those interested in studying animal behavior, like mm-hmm. Nico Tinbergen, for instance, but also those interested in studying the behavior of very small creatures like insects, for instance, and I'm thinking of Gerald Thompson, they became interested in film because they realized that it was, one, a good way of recording field observations, and second, to use those recordings to teach students and also share their discoveries with colleagues. I mean, before this conversation, I had a quick reread of the book, and I alighted on a quote by Tinbergen where he says that to him, producing a film which was shown on TV was equivalent to publishing an academic paper. So we get this idea that with scientists appropriating the film medium for their research purposes, we start seeing a kind of blurring of boundaries between addressing strictly academic scholarly audiences and addressing non-scholarly audiences. I guess scientists, by appropriating film, demonstrated to wildlife filmmakers who previously had been naturalists, who'd been very driven by the idea that if you want to film nature in a way which is intellectually honest and objective, you have to not intervene and really just observe and delegate the act of observation to the camera. Scientists bring another dimension to this conversation by saying that's not the only way of doing it. For instance, if you know about how animals behave, you can provoke those behavior, you can intervene to obtain in front of the camera the behavior you want to film and record and capture.
And that's there's a real tension there, isn't there, between sort of creating stories that are good for the camera,
yes,
on the one hand, and also being the objective observer of events. And,
yes,
and you do tell over and again in your book that tension in the making of programs,
yeah,
because in many ways nature is just boring. If you film nature, you're just capturing, mostly animals are just sleeping.
Absolutely.
Most of the time. But at the very heart of it, and again, this is why I think it's such a wonderful STS story, you've got this tension between that the scientific evidence, we're filming because we want scientific evidence of something,
yeah,
and then also storytelling.
Yeah.
And we have to splice and cut and shape and layer on top of it our own interpretation of events, mm-hmm, so that people will pay attention. Is there anybody who walks away from the industry and says, look, I'm a scientist, I just want to collect the data, I don't want to do this other stuff? Did you find anybody who just disappears?
No, I didn't come across anyone of that kind. I mean, it is, of course, perhaps biased, because most scientists involved in wildlife filmmaking who are given the possibility to speak in public are given this opportunity through the medium to which they are participating in making of documentaries. Although I should say that Nico Tinbergen got very annoyed at the fact that at what he saw as the BBC exploiting his work for its own purposes and not recognizing that he was the originator of the knowledge and content which was portrayed in films and about his research. So maybe, I know that Tinbergen just at some point said that he had enough, but that's the only example I can think about. Something which I think is important to mention is that in the work of people like Tinbergen or Thompson, and the fact that scientists demonstrated that if you had the knowledge, you could intervene, found specific resonance at the BBC because it enabled them to spend less time filming animals, to spend less time filming in nature. So, and it happened at a time when there was some pressure exerted on wildlife television producers to reduce the cost of wildlife filmmaking. And so if you can reduce the time spent in the field because you know what to expect, where to go to see it, and when to go to see it, then you can reduce the cost of filming and then the overall cost of production. So that's one other consequences of the involvement of scientists in wildlife filmmaking.
Brilliant. Now we're going to talk about the role of David Attenborough,
yeah,
in your book in just a minute. I want to get at two other ideas first, two STS ideas. And one is you talk about the notion of a telenaturalist. So what's a telenaturalist?
So it's a kind of a portmanteau word which I tried to come up with during my PhD. And it got a little bit of traction with my examiners, so I decided to keep it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it comes from the literature on sports television. Mm-hmm. I the name of the author escapes me now, but somebody came up with the idea of telexperts. Mm-hmm. To designate those people who like retired football players, for instance, who come and comment on football games live on television. And it's the idea that the television medium constitutes expertise just by the very fact that you are put forward to the audience as an expert. Mm-hmm. But you only exist as an expert on television. And the idea of the telenaturalist is somebody who's got some kind of natural history expertise only in the context of television programs. And so the existence of this expert is only on the television screen. It's basically a character which is played performed by someone, and they produce natural history knowledge by producing television programs. So they use television to produce natural history knowledge and at the same time to perform their natural history expertise.
I can think of lots of examples, and anybody listening could identify a telenaturalist on lots of different shows. There are also telehistorians and telearchaeologists and things like that, and as you said, tele-experts. And that is a fantastic relationship between those people who know a lot of stuff, and they also know the craft of how to condense it and present it. Mm. And they're typically contrasted with academics who typically don't know what to do in front of a camera, don't know what to say. But anyway, I think that's a fascinating intersection of different talents, and it must be really hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is what is striking with those people, is that they are, I mean, obviously Attenborough is the a kind of archetype for the telenaturalist, but they all have a lot of knowledge about techniques of filming, different types of cameras, back in the days, different kinds of films, but also how to behave in a studio, how to behave in front of a camera, how to rehearse a script, how to deliver a script, which is not something that you can do naturally. You have to learn all those tricks, but at the same time, they can hold a perfectly informed conversation with scientists, with naturalists, and they can even be... They can deliver some kind of expert statement on their own, and their advice can be sought, etc., etc. So it's a very complex kind of character, if you want, and public persona.
For example, we're sitting next to Regent's Canal, and there are two ducks asleep right near us, and they've been here since we started. And you and I would just say, "Oh, there's ducks and they're sleeping," but a telenaturalist would say, "Perhaps they're dramatized this after a long night of fretting over whether the fox will get them and thinking about where they're going to get their food today. These poor ducks have fallen asleep, exhausted, ready to take on the world." And that's a really quite different talent, isn't it? We'll talk about David Attenborough in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you this other question, and that is about identity fashioning that you talk about in your book, and particularly you focus your attention on something that maybe they're disappearing now, but you talk about these MODs, which is the, well, you can say what they are, and you can say where they are, and then we can talk about how they're important.
Yeah, so MODs is the acronym of making of documentaries. I don't think they are disappearing. In fact, they've tended to become a norm. And I mean, if you think of those 10-minute snippets at the end of episode of series like Planet Earth, Blue Planet 2, where, I mean, viewers are taken backstage and explained supposedly how what they've just seen has been produced. So I don't think they disappear, but they are useful tools to expand the experience of viewing and to explain, to educate viewers on how they should perceive the program which is broadcast to them. They are useful tools for wildlife filmmakers to fashion their identity, which is a notion which is coming from the history of science literature. And I think I borrowed it from Mario Biaggioli, his work on Galileo. And it's the idea that people are constantly working to create their social identity in order to achieve specific aims and occupy a specific social position, basically. And
right.
It's also adapted to Irving Goffman's work on the performance of the self in everyday life, etc., etc. So it's identity fashioning is a performative is performative. Basically, it's something that an identity is something that you construct and that you create every day in order to make sure that people perceive you as you want them to perceive you, basically.
And, as I was saying, folks, so we're in central London and the helicopters have come out, which is fantastic. You don't realize how noisy a city is if you've been away from it for a while. But let's come back to the making of documentaries, the bits on DVDs that are the sort of the extra bits quite often. So you talk about identity fashioning. And I find it's a lot easier to see the process you describe after I watched a making of documentary a couple of times. So the first time you just fall into the experience. The second time, if you listen to the presenter talk about what they're doing and why, you start hearing words like, "Yeah, I really love these animals," right? So that's a bit of identity.
Yes,
right? They care.
Yes.
And then there's, we've been here for 4 weeks and we really try to understand what they're doing. Okay, so that's another bit, that they're being slow and methodical and careful. And then also they're technically able. They've got fancy schmancy equipment, and they're out there looking at things and getting a great shot. And then, of course, the end of a making of often is they come back and say, we got the shot, right? So you've got all three of those layers. They're great filmmakers, they're caring people, and they're technically able at what they're up to.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I think it's, to return to Biagioli and his work on Galileo, what the associated notion with to identity fashioning is the notion of bricolage, which is the idea that you basically assemble, you make one thing by assembling heteroclite parts. And identity fashioning is just like this. You just grab things in the cultural repertoire you are existing in. And you assemble them to create your own identity. And as you mentioned, when you watch a making of documentary, you find that those wildlife filmmakers tend to borrow cultural markers from different cultural repertoires. So, for instance, the patience is something which is borrowed from the natural history cultural repertoire, where it is a part of what it is to be a naturalist, to spend ages in the field just to wait and observe the bird, the rare birds that you know dwells in that part of the forest but nobody has ever seen, or observe the specific behavior you want to observe, etc., etc. So that's patience. But naturalists are also drawn to nature by its aesthetic, and they are emotionally attracted to nature. And again, saying that you are emotionally attracted to nature or animals as a wildlife filmmaker is to signal, I am part of that natural history community. But at the same time, saying I'm technically literate and I can operate the camera is to say, look, I'm part of that group of filmmakers and people who can, and et cetera, et cetera. And showing that you can converse with a scientist on an equal footing, for instance, is also drawing from another repertoire, which is that of science. And then by aggregating those different bits, you can create that composite identity, which is that of the wildlife filmmaker.
And what's great, I think, about your work is that you've taken a very complex sociological idea and you've brought it down to a very specific case study. And reading about it in your work, you see that idea at work. And then I walk away from your book thinking, hey, I can apply this idea to other things too. It's a great example of STS and how it apply. If you learn a bit of STS, you can apply it much wider than science and technology studies. So with identity fashioning, we might ask, how do shop assistants fashion a certain identity, either that they're part of the company or that they're helpful or whatever, or how do politicians dress in a certain way as to project a certain image, both when they want to be official politicians and then when they're, say, on the campaign trail and they want to be informal, friendly, and whatnot. It's a fascinating idea that you can pull out of a study like yours and then apply it in lots of different areas. It's a beautiful example.
Oh, with me going on, this is a perfect place in the conversation to pause and take a break.
Are you thinking about UCL for your master's degree? The Department of Science and Technology Studies offers three MSc degrees, one in Science, Technology and Society, another in History and Philosophy of Science. And we have a new MSc in Science Communication available starting 2022. These programs are designed for specialist training, preparation for PhD programs, and practical career development. To find out more, visit us online at ucl.ac.uk/STS.
What do I like about STS? I think that the vastness and openness of the STS curriculum has really allowed me to pursue my own projects, and the staff has been really encouraging in helping me do so.
Let's get back to my conversation with Jean-Baptiste Guyon. We're talking about his research on British natural history documentaries and what they can tell us about things like communication theory. The reward you get for coming this far is that now we're going to talk about his time interviewing one of the greats in this subject, Sir David Attenborough. Let's hear what Jean-Baptiste has to say.
Right, okay, we've held it off long enough. Let's talk about Attenborough. So David Attenborough, really the master of natural history filmmaking. First, let's do a bit of basking in the glow of you. So in part of the research that you did for this project and for your research more broadly, you've studied Attenborough in terms of archives, and you've also interviewed Attenborough. Tell us about meeting David Attenborough.
Yes, so I was lucky to interview him twice. It took place at his home. So to summarize what it was to interview him, let's say that it took me 3 weeks to really recover from the encounter. Uh-huh. Maybe it's silly, but I think, starstruck, basically. And you have to reconcile with the notion that you've met in the flesh with someone you've only known ever on a television screen. But this is added to the fact that as a person, he's somebody who obviously has a lot of charisma. And he's someone who, he's been in the field for 60, 70 years now, and he knows how to handle people, basically, and keep their attention focused on him and control the conversation. And it was a very pleasant pair of encounters, really. I will always remember when he opened the door of his house after I had knocked. It was like drawing a curtain, and he darted his blue eyes at me, saying, "Hello, I'm David Attenborough."
As if you wouldn't know.
The best thing is that the second time I came to his house, he wasn't there because he had forgotten. He had done a double booking, and so I had to leave. And he came back shortly after I had left, and he phoned at my home. And my wife took up the phone, and he said, "Hello, my name is David Attenborough."
That's brilliant. Right, so in addition to helicopters and passers-by, now we've got the canal boat. So back to Attenborough. Why did you want to talk with him?
The honest answer is that I wanted to talk to him because, and I think it's part of identity fashioning, I suppose, but when you say that you're writing a book on wildlife television in Britain, if you can't say, "Yes, I've spoken with Attenborough," people, and publishers notably, won't be interested in your book.
Right.
Because they won't believe that you've been able to understand the object. Mm-hmm. It was to provide myself with credentials,
yes,
I suppose. In fact, David Attenborough has written his memoirs. He's written countless first-hand accounts of everything he's done. And he's also somebody who controls very tightly the narrative about himself as it happens in public. He's somebody who constantly fashions his identity.
Yes.
And so he exerts a very tight control about the public discourse about himself and how he's seen, how he appears in public, etc., etc. And so his own discourse about himself is extremely well rehearsed. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine that when you ask him questions at 90 years old about what he did 50 years ago, not only his memories will have solidified, but in fact what you find is that he only says to you what you've read countless of times in interviews, in autobiographical accounts, etc., etc. So to some extent, interviewing him is not fundamental to understanding wildlife television. What is interesting, though, is that meeting the person on the pretext of wanting to interview him on his history as a wildlife filmmaker gives you something that you won't get by reading archival papers or interviews, which is getting a feel for the guy, basically. Mm-hmm. So there is something which I may talk about, is that after the book had been published, I sent him a copy. Mm-hmm. And he first wrote me back like 2 days after receiving it, which is basically what he always does, saying thank you very much, and if I find any mistakes, I will write back to you. And so I spent the following weeks and months anxiously checking my pigeonhole in the department, and one day, what did I find? A very thick envelope. Addressed in the hand of David Attenborough. And I opened it very excitedly and apprehensively, I should say. And so there was this manuscript letter, which was very nice, actually, saying that he had read the book cover to cover, and he really liked it, and he was very appreciative of everything I was saying about him, etc., etc. but that there were episodes in the book with which he did not agree. Mm-hmm. And he said this thing. I framed the letter in my maybe it's a bit narcissistic, but in my office. But in that letter, he says something like, "I understand that you will not agree with me because you've got archival evidence, but my own memories of those episodes is different from what you find in the archives." And so he sent me 10 pages of corrections. Mm-hmm. So there was one page of typos. All the typos he had found in the book, and then 10 pages of alternative accounts of those episodes based on his memory of those episodes.
Right. How do you relate his recollections with the factual evidence then? How do you yourself balance? We'll step back from which is truthful. How do you balance those, the recollections and the archival evidence?
I mean, the way in which I read the archives does not necessarily reveal the way in which Attenborough was understanding what he was doing at the time. But there is also this idea of constantly controlling his public image and mm-hmm. public identity. Over the years, he's managed to create a narrative which is very coherent, which has a beginning, a middle, and not yet an ending, happily. And so everything that detracts from this narrative, storytelling, is potentially problematic. And what is interesting is that not only did he send me this document, but he mentioned in the letter that he was also sending a copy of it to the BBC archives, so that for future historians, his reaction to my book would be available for them to reevaluate my account and then perhaps come up with an alternative account of the story I was telling in my book. I mean, it's incredible to see how precise and, I mean, the level of thinking mm-hmm. behind that. This idea that you need not only to control what happens in public, but also to have some form of agency when it comes to archival records.
He has such an awareness of what stories are being constructed around him, and he's playing a role in building those stories.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And one colleague wrote a book about environmental celebrities, and for his book he wanted to interview David Attenborough. And in the preface of the book, he tells the story that he arrived at Attenborough's place and prefaced his interview with the notion that Attenborough is a celebrity, to which Attenborough said, "I'm sorry, I disagree with you, I'm not a celebrity, I don't want to talk to you, bye-bye," and he threw him out of his house.
Fascinating. Well, I mean, this is a brilliant example of a real contrast. We started our conversation about talking about science communication and science journalism, and you and I regularly have this challenge when we're teaching and developing programs about tradecraft. So how do you interview someone? How do you get the best out of that? And then interpretation and how to make use of what the information we've gathered from an interview. And this is a brilliant example because you have the tradecraft. You can go and interview someone and you can write about what they said, then interpreting it becomes so complicated, doesn't it? And you've nicely applied a couple of sociological tools to interpret. And so identity fashioning is a really good example of what Attenborough is doing. And it's not meant to criticize him and say he's a bad person. It's just simply saying he's doing it along the lines of saying, well, everybody does it. And I think in my own example of doing oral history, I think of a beautiful case where interviewing combat veterans as soon as they return from an engagement, and then 3 years later, you ask them the same questions about what happened on that day in that way, and you get very, very different answers. And it sounds like your story about Attenborough is a good example, too, that you've got archives and then stories 40 years later that don't match. And it's not that one is right and one is wrong. It's that the human being is doing different processing at different points. And that's what the sociologist does. That's what STS does. Yeah. And in a way, that I would say that distinguishes your work in science communication away from the kind of journalistic job of getting a story, writing a story, producing something for people to read.
Yeah.
Does that sound like I've got that just about right?
Yes, I think it's a good summary, I think. And thank you for bringing in the oral history thing, because that's what I was thinking about when I was mentioning that. But yeah.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful example. And again, it's not about right. It's not about one truth competing against another truth. It's just sitting back and asking, what are we human beings doing? And you're just dealing with an incredibly famous, fantastically generous person. Well, let me ask you two more questions before we're done. And so this book, your book came out in 2019. So what have you been doing since? What's your current research on?
I mean, the book concluded almost 15 years of research. I had been working on the history of wildlife television in Britain for 15 years, starting with my PhD. And so I really had the impression of having finished something. So for a few months, I've been really looking for new topics and new questions. So I'm working on several things at different levels of completion. Mm-hmm. So I think the one which is mostly related to what I've been doing so far is to try and look at jointly the history of wildlife filmmaking and the history of wildlife conservation. Mm-hmm. To test the hypothesis that wildlife conservation, to some extent, and in the way in which it is presented to in public, is what I would call a cinematic project, which means that the object of wildlife conservation is thought about in cinematic terms, and I want to unpack what that term cinematic means. And so I think it's a book project, so I will need to go to archives when they reopen after the lockdown, which I'm really looking forward to. And in the book, I want to talk about Peter Scott, Julian Huxley, Jacques Cousteau, Attenborough again, to an extent, Bernard Jimek in Germany. All those people who've been key actors in the wildlife conservation movement, at the same time have been key players in wildlife filmmaking, to see how their engagement with the filmmaking technology has influenced or shaped the way in which they thought about wildlife conservation and how they wanted to present it to the public as a global project, if you want.
And listeners can do this themselves in a way, watching any natural history program and just listen out for the pivot.
Yes.
when they stop sort of showing you nature, showing you the lioness chasing the gazelle, and then pivot and say, oh, well, we really should say lions.
Yeah.
And just watch how that happens and then watch what happens next. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a nice way to sort of prepare for your book that's coming.
Absolutely.
Right, Jean-Baptiste, the last question I want to ask you is, I heard this rumor that STS is going to start a new master's program. A master's program in science communication. And I heard that you're going to play a key role in that. Do you want to say something about that?
I will gladly say something about it, but perhaps we can wait until we manage to get hold of Melanie Smulman, who is the co-director of this forthcoming program with me. And we've been working together to shape the program and think about what would go into the different courses. So maybe that will be the object of a future conversation.
Oh, so it's a teaser, right? Okay, well, we're going to get Melanie in and we'll get you in. Hopefully the three of us can come together, I don't know, maybe in a building site or something where we've got lots and lots of background noise. Anyway, Jean-Baptiste, thank you so much for coming into London. It's been really great talking to you, and good luck with your research.
Thank you very much, Joe. It was a real pleasure to have this conversation on the side of Regent's Canal, and we stopped just as another narrow boat is coming in. So,
brilliant. Thanks very much.
Thanks to Jean-Baptiste for taking the time for our own little outside broadcast, and thanks to you for persevering through the canal boats, the helicopters, the building works, and everything else. I confess, though, I like the ducks and the coots, so I might invite them along for another time. If you know somebody who might like to study with us, ask them just to get in touch. Whether it's science communication, science policy, history of science, or philosophy of science, we love our work, and we're always happy to talk. And we're a thriving community, too. This year, in fact, we celebrate 100 years of our subject at UCL. Hey, does anybody know if we get a telegram from the Queen for that? Music today included two pieces, Rollin' at 5 by Kevin MacLeod and Silly Intro by Alexander Nakarada. Both are available online at filmmusic.io. You also heard in the break pieces by Jasmine Chakravarti, UCL Class of 2021, and Pierre-Elie Bolson, who hopes to be UCL Class of 2023. Thanks, you two. Nice work. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, visit us online. Here's the address, so write this down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. And that's it for today. Thanks for coming along, and we'll have another episode ready soon. Until then, or until next time, everybody, just remember that together we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS. It's a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.